About 3 years ago, I had the idea to do this. I'm a comedy writer now. I went back to film school at UCLA and got my MFA in screenwriting after being in The Room. So I write a lot of comedy scripts, and I thought, you know, I'm in this, the worst movie ever made, quote unquote. I write comedy, so why not put that together and do something fun with the other actors to poke fun at ourselves? Part of it was just that we are constantly seeing, you know, aren't necessarily our names, but sometimes our names in the press as people talk about The Room, and they always say, you know, Citizen Kane, a bad movie and the worst movie ever made. And our names are always like thrown in there. And if you Google my name, the first thing that pops up is The Room. So I can't get away from it. It's in our lives, and it will be forever, I guess, as long as The Room keeps being popular. And I think more and more people are discovering The Room, so I think it will continue to grow in popularity. So I figured, you know, what do I have to lose? Our names are already associated with it, so why not have some fun with it?
Robin Paris, one of the stars of the famously awful 2003 film, The Room. We'll hear more from her later in the show as we explore what happens when things don't go quite to plan. Today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
After the new edit, we were happy. And it seemed to us, yes, we found the movie. We found the rhythm of the movie.
I'll sit down for afternoon tea with two of Europe's most celebrated filmmakers, two-time Palme d'Or winners, the Dardenne brothers. Plus,
seeing a man with his lips stitched in close-up, I find quite confronting. I find seeing the conditions in the camp confronting, the fact that people have been living in these, like, shitty, mouldy tents.
Oscar winner Eva Orner takes us inside Australia's notoriously harsh asylum seeker policies with her new documentary, Chasing Asylum. That's all to come today on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Hello from Midori House here in London. I'm Ben Rylan. The 60th edition of this city's film festival wraps in just a matter of days. And indeed, if films reflect the social mood, politics and diversity were unsurprisingly close to the surface of this year's festival. Since coming to power in 2013, Australia's Conservative government has enforced an enormously harsh border protection policy. As part of its mission to destroy the business model of people smugglers, Australia's military patrol the nation's borders, towing any boats they intercept back to their place of origin. Any asylum seekers who do reach Australia by boat are held in offshore detention centres where, even if they're found to be refugees, they're given no hope of ever settling in Australia.
We have a proud record of welcoming people from 140 different nations. But we will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come.
That's Australia's second longest-serving Prime Minister, John Howard, the man many credit with introducing asylum seekers into the Australian political dialogue. The new documentary from Academy Award winner Eva Orner doesn't argue over how Australia ought to be designing its immigration policies. Instead, it focuses on those anonymous offshore prisons known as detention centres, and asks, sure, Australia has stopped the boats, but at what cost?
We will do whatever we reasonably can, consistent with the principles of a decent and humane society, to ensure that the boats stay stopped.
The government will tell you the boats have stopped. Boats still come to Australia, not in the numbers that they used to and nothing like the rest of the world, but boats do come to Australia, but because of this really dark secrecy policy, we are not even told what boats come into our waters. And when boats come in, a boat recently came in from Sri Lanka with asylum seekers, they were taken on shore, put into a bus with blackened windows, men, women and children, and flown out of the country within 24 hours. And a bunch of them ended up in prison in Sri Lanka. And journalists aren't allowed access to them. They're just completely counted as non-human. The other thing the Australian government does is turn back boats, and there's evidence that the Australian government paid people smugglers cash a lot of cash to turn boats around and take asylum seekers back to Indonesia, breaking more international conventions. And so what's really interesting is they say we're trying to break the people smuggler model, yet there's evidence that they've paid people smugglers to return people. And this whole death at sea argument, if they're returning the boats back to Indonesia, that's double the time on the water in these rickety boats with asylum seekers, so their chance of drowning is doubled. But I took the tack to simplify the argument in the film. The assumption is, and overall, look, the boats have stopped, the policy does work, but at what cost?
You go from looking after people to saying, if you come here, we're going to make it worse for you than if you'd stayed where you came from.
Staff would have to be trained how to use a Hoffman's knife. The knife used to cut people down when they're found hanging.
I have to forget my dreams here.
Children have to be in detention according to the government's policies because it's part of the deterrence.
They're growing up on white phosphate rock in mouldy, damp tents where they have no privacy and no space. You'll have clients say to you, please come back, please don't forget about us, please don't leave us here.
Seeing a man with his lips stitched in close-up, I find quite confronting. I find seeing the conditions in the camp confronting. The fact that people have been living in these, like, shitty, mouldy tents. You see children kind of walking around, looking very stunned and dazed. Australia is the only country in the world that puts children in indefinite detention. And I feel like when you see the children, it really hits home. And there, you know, there's a lot of stories saying that the children now refer to themselves and each other by their boat number IDs that they're given when they come into the camps, which is what the guards call them. So the kids now no longer use their names after 1,000 days. They use their numbers. And to me, that's something that I find very, very hard to take. At peak hysteria in Australia, the most people that ever came by boat to Australia in 1 year was 30,000. Now look at Europe. Australia's 67th in the world in our refugee intake. Europe should be so angry with Australia. If we were taking more people, the load would be slightly lessened from the burden that's on Europe. And that's something that Australia never talks about. What we've done instead is lower our refugee intake to 13,750. I'm all about stopping the boats. The boats are a disaster in terms of safety for people because, you know, it's estimated about 20% of the boats capsize and people die. And also the voyage from, like, Libya to Italy or Greece is a couple of hours. To come from Indonesia to Australia is 5 to 7 days on open ocean. It's horrific. And we've got a lot of footage of that in the film. I mean, it's terrifying. What Australia should be doing is very similar to what Malcolm Fraser did in the 70s, and we show this in the film when the Vietnamese boat people started coming to Australia. Malcolm Fraser said, we had to help. I felt like we had to help them just out of sheer humanity, but also because we were involved militarily in the war, which was the cause of why people were fleeing.
Malcolm Fraser, of course, was a Conservative Prime Minister.
He was a Tory, basically.
Later became very, very outspoken against his own party.
Yeah, and the film's dedicated to him because I did one of the last interviews with him before he died, and it sort of breaks my heart even thinking about it. But what's so interesting is that he very quickly said, OK, we have to help these people. The ones that arrived by boat, you know, he was like, get them to shore, let's get them, you know, food and clothing and shelter. But very quickly he established a camp, a processing camp, a really comfortable, humane camp in Malaysia. People were processed under the convention within 6 to 8 weeks. And then he sort of says in the film with quite a wryly smile, you know, a bit of a, it doesn't take a genius to work this out, guys, you know, that kind of implication. And he says, once they were processed, we flew them to Australia and therefore there were no deaths at sea. We stopped the boats, but we by bringing people to Australia, and we resettled like 70,000 Vietnamese people, and through family reunion, ultimately about 150,000. And that's what we should be doing now. Like, nobody's saying, let's let everyone in. You know, the Australian government will have you believe we're being invaded and millions of people are coming to Australia by boat, which is absolute rubbish. I mean, most people don't want to come to Australia. It's far away, it's foreign, it's hard to get to. You have to pay a lot of money to people smugglers. So it's a really small amount of people in terms of the world refugee crisis that are coming to Australia. But what we should be doing is upping our intake to 50,000. Nothing hysterical. We're not crazy. We're not saying let in 500,000 people. Just 50,000. Just a little nod to the world that we want to try and help. And I figured because of the policy of secrecy, nobody had seen inside the camps because you're not allowed to get into the camps. No filmmakers, journalists or cameras are allowed in. So no one's ever really seen what it looks like. And the asylum seekers have no identity. They've been completely dehumanised. So I thought, what if I could show it? So it became, I mean, it was retrospectively, I look back and I just think, God, I can't believe I made this film, because it was an impossible film to make. It's about places you're not allowed to go to, people you're not allowed to film. And what was the most interesting was halfway through the making of the film, our Border Force Protection Act came out, which is legislation. And in it is this really odious whistleblowing clause that says, if you work at the detention centres on Manus or Nauru and you speak out about what's going on there, it's a criminal act with 2 years jail. And so halfway through the making of the film, it became a criminal act, making the film. And so we had this massive team of lawyers who were advising us. And through me coercing people essentially to film inside the camps, I fell under that legislation as well.
Following the recent election, Australia's tough border protection measures remain in place. It's been more than 2 years since the last people smuggling boat made it to Australia. We've turned back every boat and every person since then. Don't trust people smugglers. Don't endanger your family's future. Settlement in Australia will never be an option if you try to come illegally by boat without a visa. The rules apply to everyone. There are no exceptions.
The legislation's untested and the government's never used it, but the fact that it exists. So if you're like a doctor working on Nauru and you speak out about sexual abuse of children, that's a criminal offence with 2 years jail time. But doctors speak out. So we've all sort of banded together. And one of the things the film has done is embolden more whistleblowers to speak out, because we got away with it. But the law is sort of a little bit unclear and it's untested. And I had a group of criminal barristers, you know, kind of mooting the legislation, and they all felt that I had to really watch myself. And so, you know, whenever I travel in and out of the country, my lawyers have all my flight details, and I text them when I land and I text them when I get through customs. And the same with all our whistleblowers. We had to provide them with full human rights and criminal legal experts advising them.
There were 2,000 children in detention in Australia at the end of the Labor government. Do you know how many there are now? None. And that's because of the fact that we have a strong policy. We have closed 14 of 17 detention centres in Australia. We've been able to do that because we have stopped the boats. Now, I grant you, it is tough. It is tough. But the alternative is far worse. And that is what I, as Prime Minister, that's the tough choice that you entrust me to make as this nation's leader.
Eva Orner's documentary Chasing Asylum is screening at the London Film Festival and is also rolling out on various platforms around the world. Some of the audio we heard there is from Eva's film. We also heard an official advertising campaign by the Australian government aimed at potential asylum seekers. And that final clip was the nation's current Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. We've just stepped outside of Midori House and across town to the Mayfair Hotel, where I'm due to meet a couple of European filmmaking giants. Luc and Jean-Pierre Dardenne are members of a very exclusive club. They've won the Palme d'Or in Cannes not once, but twice. First for 1999's Rosetta, and again in 2005 with The Child. Their latest film is titled The Unknown Girl and tells the story of a young doctor dealing with the guilt of knowing that she failed to answer a call from someone who was later the victim of a terrible crime. When it premiered in Cannes, however, audiences weren't exactly delighted. I sat down for a cup of Earl Grey with the Dardenne brothers and asked Jean-Pierre how it felt to be such an accomplished filmmaker dealing with a bout of unexpected disappointment.
Because after Cannes, the reactions were mixed. Some good, some bad, and some less good. And we spoke with some friends who are critics, and they told us, maybe your film is a little bit too clinical. Yes, maybe. Well, okay. We thought about that, we spoke about. And when we came back in Belgium, we called our editor, and we told her, we will come back in the editing room.
These brothers are two of the most acclaimed forces of cinema in the world. It's incredibly rare to win the Palme d'Or twice. Only 7 other filmmakers have ever done it. And yet, hearing the Dardens tell the story of how they re-edited their film, they're surprisingly unbothered.
After the new edit, we were happy. And it seemed to us, yes, we found the movie. We found the rhythm of the movie. Then why? We don't know why, but I think for the first time for this movie, A Young Girl, we didn't take holidays between the shooting and the editing.
Luke thinks that a certain distance between film and filmmaker is healthy. He speaks so fondly of being immersed in the creative process, but admits that it's also exhausting.
I love to start a new movie. I love that. And I hope I love that a long time. But it, for me, when we discuss about the next movie, about the character, I love that. I love this time.
While they were clearly enthusiastic when discussing their latest film and the re-editing process, I soon discover that the best way to make these brothers feel at home is by looking deeper into their overall affection for the art. They've been making films since the 1970s and carry quite the reputation for their blend of social realism and tense drama, which makes me wonder whether the weight of all that reputation ever becomes a little too heavy.
At the end, yes, but when you are inside, sometimes no, sometimes yes, because you think I don't find the right way to express what we want. It's wow, it's a kind of habit, shit. Sometimes I think that, but sometimes I'm not right to think that. But I can't avoid this kind of thought in my mind. I'm like this. No, it depends on the days, but sometimes yes. And it's more difficult, no, than in the beginning.
One might imagine that winning the Palme d'Or twice might carry with it some degree of confidence, that perhaps all that anticipation that swells every time the Dardens have something in the pipeline might put them in, well, some sort of godlike category of artist. But as I take the last sip of my tea, Jean-Pierre lets out an affectionate laugh and muses over the prestige that their films tend to carry. He's not dismissive of all that attention, quite the opposite, but neither of them seem to take it all too seriously.
Sometimes I prefer you haven't made any film before. But it's not true, it's impossible. And at the same time, you have to try again the fresh of the first film. But it's not really the same, because maybe the most difficult behavior is to be like Jenny, like a young filmmaker, like she's a young doctor.
Like a child.
Like a child, you know. And to have the feeling that we discover something. Yes, we try to do our best. Sometimes it's work, sometimes it works a little bit less.
Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne speaking to me at the Mayfair Hotel here in London. Still to come on today's show, one of the cast members of the notoriously bad movie, The Room, tells us about the moment she discovered her performance in the film would be remembered, but for all the wrong reasons. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Stay tuned.
Do you like bad movies? No, neither do we. But don't worry, we've discovered a cure for bad films. It's called MUBI.
Sometimes Wells' films aren't very nourishing, they're very exciting. Citizen Kane, I think, absolutely wins the competition for the film that has made more people want to become a filmmaker than any other.
Every day, MUBI adds a new must-see film to its carefully curated selection. No junk-filled mess or endless scrolling. Just an assembly of the best movies from all over the world waiting to be devoured. To sample a whole month of movies for free, just head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Hurry now, the film's about to start.
You're back with The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Ryland. Today's program has been focusing on what happens when things start going terribly wrong, from the basis of your film suddenly being declared illegal, to a pair of double Palme d'Or winners being booed in Cannes. But imagine if you got to a point in your career that made you feel as though you were completely out of step to everyone around you, that really, your life's work was just one big misstep. On last week's show, we heard the first chapter of the secretly recorded autobiography by a man who once found himself reviewing films of a certain pedigree for a prestigious Metropolitan daily. Of course, times have changed. They just don't make movies like they used to. And for our esteemed critic, he isn't having a bar of it.
Memoirs of a Disgruntled Critic, Chapter 2. When I saw the masses of so-called teens lining up to get into Suicide Squad, the latest clump of fetid ambergris vomited up by the flailing whale of what can loosely be dubbed the film industry, I wept. I wept not for the teens themselves. Having attained the age of reason, they are now fully responsible for their own choices, and the grotesquely malformed brain structures they will suffer as a consequence of their decision to attend screenings of this audiovisual tumour on the bowel of popular culture. Nor did I weep for that Western culture itself. Any civilization that reduces its noblest art forms to a mere delivery system for product placement and souvenir cola cups, and its brightest and most talented creatives to starving wage slaves, barely clinging to their fragile employment at a once great but now repellently ungrateful journal of record, that civilization does not deserve to have its culture respected. No, I wept, simply and elegantly, as I do all things, for myself. For this is not a world in which I want to live. And this is not a world in which I deserve to live. Not 3 miles from the very multiplex where Suicide Squad was laying waste to a generation's neurons lies a quaint, independent cinema, showing only the very best in vintage and arthouse film. Screening at the same time was La Vache du Tristesse, an impossibly moving meditation of art, grief, and capitalism, told by a monologue of the Pope over the course of a single 3-hour bowel movement. Sure, it doesn't have the budget of Suicide Squad, or the star power, or the special effects, or the action, or excitement. But it has something money can't buy. A dream sequence wherein the ghost of Toshiro Mifune gives birth to a pelican. Can Mr. Zack Snyder, or Mr. Brett Ratner, or Mr. Todd Phillips, or any of the corporate harlots currently befouling the vomitorium of modern Hollywood match such imagination, such daring, such steadfast refusal to cater to popular tastes, or indeed to any tastes at all? No, today we would rather watch the limp cavorting of the Joker, a pale facsimile, of course, of Conrad Veidt as Gwynplaine in The Man Who Laughs, as he fires a million bullets into the brain of the collective consciousness. And so I weep. Not for the cultural suicide this squad represents, but only that once lobotomized by modern entertainment, audiences will no longer know what they miss out on when they fail to read my column.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Now, this year has seen its share of cinematic catastrophes, perhaps most notably that big-budget remake of Ben-Hur, which cost about $100 million and grossed just $80 million. Now, you'd think with all those focus groups and big data that movie studios might have come up with a fail-safe formula by now. But there are many different breeds of turkey, and not all disasters are quite what they seem.
Hi.
Can I help you?
Yeah, can I have a dozen red roses, please?
Oh, hi, Johnny. I didn't know it was you. Here you go.
That's me. How much is it?
It'll be $18.
Here you go. Keep the change. Hi, doggy.
You're my favorite customer.
The Room was the work of writer, director, and just about everything else, Tommy Wiseau. And for actress Robin Paris, it seemed like the perfect opportunity to make her mark on the big screen. But As Kiran Banerjee found out, that's not quite how things worked out.
There was an ad in Backstage West, which is the trade paper. I guess it was 13 years ago. And I had just moved to L.A., and so I'd been submitting my headshots to a lot of open calls and castings. And I sent in my headshot, basically. And then I think I got a call a couple weeks later from Greg Sestero asking me to come in to audition for The Room. And I didn't know anything about it at all till I got there. And I got there early because I had a play that I was in Hollywood that night. So I wanted to kind of get, you know, hammer out the audition and get to the play. And I met Tommy. I was the first person there, and he asked me, you know, about my background and as an actor. And at the end of the conversation, he was basically like, well, I think I'm going to cast you. We have to airbrush all your freckles out, but I like you. I think you got the part. And I'm like, I didn't even audition. But I did proceed to audition after that. A bunch of people got to the set, and I read with a few people, read the Chocolate is the Symbol of Love scene with Greg Ellery, who ended up playing Steven. He went to that casting as well. And I found out later that I was basically a mid-season replacement. They had already been filming The Room for months, and they had to replace Michelle because Juliette Danielle was originally playing Michelle, but then she moved to Lisa. And so they needed to replace that character. And so they did this open call to replace me, and they knew that Kyle Vogt was also leaving. He plays Peter, and so they, you know, they hired Greg to take his place. And you might remember from The Room where, you know, Peter, the psychologist, basically just disappears midway through the movie.
Yeah.
And then Greg Ellery, who plays Steven, just sort of shows up. And with no explanation, it's like two-thirds of the way, or three-fourths of the way into the movie, there's just a different guy there. And he gets all of Peter's lines, and nobody knows who he is.
When you first met Tommy Wiseau, was that any indication to possibly how it would be like working on a project like that or with him himself? Or did that come later during the process?
Yes, it was an indication. And I thought he was unusual but nice. I had just moved to L.A. from Chicago. I'm originally from North Carolina. But the reputation on the like in North Carolina where I grew up of L.A. is that there's just a lot of crazy people there. And so when I auditioned, I was like, oh, yeah, he's just one of those normal, that's a typical L.A. person. I thought, you know, I was just so naive. I was like, yeah, that's just normal. That's how people are in L.A. So, and that was not the case, as I figured out. But yeah, I mean, he was unusual and eccentric. But, you know, that's all I took from him is that, I mean, as it went along, obviously, we got to know him better. All the actors did and realized, you know, I actually never saw a script. So I didn't even know, like, how the movie was going to proceed.
Was there a general feeling on set that what was happening could develop into this cult classic?
I invited my husband to the set, he came for the scene at the end when it was the big party scene. We're all there, and Juliet and Greg are slow dancing, and it was so funny. Just being an actor in that scene was just as funny as watching it on screen, and I was trying so hard not to laugh. And it's like, kind of like trying not to laugh in church. You know, the more you try, the worse it gets. And I started crying with laughter, like just tears were streaming down my face because I was trying to hold it in. And I said to my husband that night, I was like, you know what? This will never see the light of day. But if it ever does, I think it would get a cult following because this is so crazy. I mean, it was so funny. Just even being there was funny.
Was Tommy serious? Did he feel the same things that you did in the film? Did he think this will become a cult classic? Or did he think he was making fantastic cinema?
I think he thought he was making fantastic cinema.
What do you think makes a film like that a cult classic?
I think it's the unintentional hilarity, and I think it's the sincerity with which it was done. I think if you shot that movie with the intention of making it really funny, it wouldn't be funny. I think it was the sincere intention to make it a drama and the complete failure of that on so many levels that makes it funny.
Robin Paris, the star of the quite terrible film, The Room, speaking to Kiran Banerjee. Which brings us to the end of today's show. Next week, it's our design special as we sit down with Shane Valentino, production designer on Tom Ford's much-anticipated new film, Nocturnal Animals. Today's show was edited by Kiran Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Memoirs of a Disgruntled Critic is written by Ben Pobje and performed by Barney Burnham. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio. And of course, The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.